Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. This is the 14th of February, so we're about halfway through the period of our winter retreat, our official 3 months retreat time for the year. And this is also St. Valentine's Day, I've been reminded. Listening to the frogs calling out to each other, they've been sending out their invitations, sending their valentines for several days since the warm weather began. And it's good to reflect on different aspects of our lives and the different things that affect us as human beings. And one of the things that affects us is the way that we connect or bond to other people. Today in the customs of the West and also spreading out into Asia, I think in Thailand they make a big killing on red roses. This particular day they've infected the Thai culture with the meme of Valentine's Day, so that the red rose marketers have found a niche there. These things are particularly recollected, this quality of romance and love between people is recollected, embellished, empowered. This particular day of the year in the Western culture, Western thinking. But just reflecting on that and considering that place, how that relates in contrast between the Western cultural model and that of Buddha Dhamma. Now, in many respects, in the Western society, if you look at literature or the media, songs, stories, movies, The ultimate reality or the ultimate aspiration of human life in many respects in the Western thinking is romantic love that lasts forever, the love that will never die. You and me together forever. And that kind of idea or that myth of perfect romantic love is held up in the highest possible ways. It's exalted beyond pretty much anything else. They don't really have an idea of enlightenment or liberation within the Judeo-Christian thinking that's anywhere remotely near the popular thinking that for the average person. Romantic love and growing old, living happily ever after, together forever, is the model for the ultimate happiness. I don't think I'm being too extravagant, or I know I have a tendency to make sweeping statements and grand generalizations, but I don't think I'm going too far off the mark to state that. You know, this is pretty much the fact in the West. You listen to any song, read pretty much any story, watch virtually any movie, and paradigm is embedded in it. They lived happily ever after. That's the model, the vision of the ultimate good, or the perfection of a human completeness. But when we consider that in the light of Buddhist teachings, however, there's a somewhat of a different take on things, and that the Buddha more emphasized pleasant aspects of romantic love between people and that kind of bonding, the painfulness or the danger, the adinava, the liability that comes with that as well. And as it's in the Buddhist fairy tale that I helped to edit and publish a few years ago, it was like a re-editing of a Buddhist novel that was written in the early part of the 20th century by a Danish writer, Carl Gillerup. The story follows the relationship between two people. They start off as people, and then they go through being devatas and end up as Brahma gods. But the pivot of the story is where the heroine, the heroine and the hero have got separated from each other. She believes he's lost to her, and she becomes a Buddhist nun. And believing she's put her infatuation, her love for the hero, Carmenita, behind her, she goes to see the Buddha. She's been a nun for a couple of years. And the Buddha discerns that far from having got over her romantic attachment, she's still really stuck on her former beloved. And so that the theme for contemplation that he gives her, she asks for some subject for meditation, and rather than giving her something like the investigation of anatta or the contemplation of dependent origination or something abstruse and profound and subtle, what he says to her, the sentence he gives her, the contemplation, is where there is love, there is suffering. And so she feels a bit hard done by when she gets that. Oh, I thought I was going to get something. I waited till the end. I waited to be last so you could give me a really profound and deep and subtle theme for investigation. But he's given me this really shallow and superficial. Easy contemplation. I mean, this is, well, there's nothing much to that, so why did he give me that? But then, as she investigates it and lives with it, then she begins to realize, oh, the reason why he gave it to me was because there is still that bond, that attachment. There's still that thorn wedged under the skin that's still in there, having its effect, influencing the whole system. And then she realizes, finally, after a considerable length of time, that that's something that she has to let go and to free the heart from. Yeah, she doesn't get it at first, and she resents it and wrestles with it, but finally realizes the Buddha was right. So even though that's in a novel, the author wove together a number of teachings from particularly from the Pali canon that are the source of that particular reflection, that you find the Buddha saying very similar things in a number of different places. And one of the notable instances of that is where the the Buddha is meditating in one of the parks, I believe, in the area around the great city of Savatthi. And there's a discussion brews up between him and another local person, between the Buddha and this person from Savatthi. And they, in the course of this discussion, this person says, this fellow says, that happiness comes from those who are dear to us. And the Buddha says, no, those who are dear to us are the cause of pain and suffering. And he said, that's rubbish, what nonsense, what, you're talking garbage, you don't know anything, what kind of a spiritual teacher are you? You're totally upside down. So then he wanders off and finds a small group of other people gambling, playing dice or gambling with each other a bit of a distance away. And he says, my contention is, well, I believe that those whom we love are the source of happiness in our lives. They're the source of joy and delight. But that monk over there, he says that those whom we love are the source of suffering. Yeah. And they said, well, he doesn't know what he's talking about. He's totally stupid. Everyone knows that that's the source of happiness and joy in our lives. So, yeah, of course it is. Well, he's completely upside down. And so then, agreeing with the gamblers, and the fellow goes off, and then in the course of conversations, he spreads it around that this monk who he encountered came up with this totally stupid, erroneous teaching that love is the cause of suffering, cause of pain. So as the story goes, that this rumbled around the gossip mill of Savatthi for some time and eventually ended up at the palace and came up in discussion between King Basenadi and Queen Malika. And when King Basenadi heard this, he said, well, I mean, it's obvious that those whom we love are the source of great happiness and joy and delight in our lives. I mean, everybody knows that. And then Queen Malika says, well, if the Blessed One has said that those whom we love, those who are dear to us, are the cause of suffering, then I would tend to side with the Blessed One, because it's never the case that he's wrong. It's always the case that he's right. And then in true regal authoritarian mode, King Pasinari says, ha, pa! Whatever that Samana Gotama says, Malika, you always agree with him. And enough of this. Away with you! I mean, just because he says that you think it's true, but this is totally ridiculous, and I can't possibly believe this for a moment. And she says, "Well, have it your own way, Your Majesty. But I still, not wishing any disrespect to you, I still feel that the Master, the Lord Buddha, is correct." So, sometime shortly after, then they have occasion to meet with the Buddha. And King Basenadi raises the question with him and says, I heard it said that you had stated that suffering is born from those who are dear to us, those whom we love, are the cause of suffering and unhappiness and pain. And I think you must have been misquoted. I think they must have got this story back to front, because I can't possibly believe that that's what you said. I mean, it's obvious, it's common sense. Everyone knows that those whom we love, our dear ones, are the source of great happiness and joy. They're the source of fulfillment in our lives. And the Buddha said, that's absolutely correct. That's what I said. Those who are dear to us, those whom we love, are the cause of sorrow and pain. And so then King Pasenadi says, well, how can this be? This is preposterous. This is ridiculous. It's absurd. The Buddha then says, well, great king, is the princess Vajiri your daughter? Is she dear to you? He says, well, of course, she's my most beloved child. I mean, she's a very lovely girl. I love her very much. Well, if she's dear to you, if you love her very much, how would you feel if something unpleasant happened to her? If some change came about that had a negative effect upon her? If there was some change of that nature, how would you feel? Well, I'd be very upset. I'd be really distraught, and I would be experiencing a lot of suffering. And then, as the light begins to dawn on King Pasenadi, the Buddha, with with great thoroughness then says, well, what about Queen Mallika? If something unpainful and unpleasant, a change came about with respect to her, how would you feel? Oh, that would be very unpleasant. That would be most unfortunate. I'd be very unhappy about that. And what about your chief minister? And what about the prince? And what about the royal guard? And what about the city of Sarvati? And what about the nation of Kosala? And goes through this long, long list of different things that the king is close to and fond of and is dear to are dear to his heart. And each time then the king is forced to say yes if some change came about, if some negative turn of circumstance affected this person or this people or this or the city or the nation, yes, I would feel sorrow and pain and unhappiness and misery. I would suffer. And so after the end of this long list, by the time the Buddha has rammed his point home to the bone, he says, that is why, great king, I said, those who are dear to us, those that we love, are the cause of suffering, the cause of pain, the cause of unhappiness to us. And then in another exchange, similarly, the Buddha is again in Sarvati. And at that time, the great lay disciple, Visakha, who had many, many children, the story, legend has it, she had 20 children, and each of those 20 children had 20 children, so she was reputed to have 400 grandchildren by the end of her life. So she was the great mother of Sarvati and also the donor of the Eastern Park and that monastery, the Eastern Park. And one day she came into the monastery having just come from a funeral ceremony. So and in that time, some aspect of the funeral ceremonies involved having water sprinkled over one's head and clothing and so forth. And so she came to the monastery, and her hair was wet, and her clothes were wet, and it was in the middle of the daytime. And the Buddha said, what is it, Visakha, that brings you here to the monastery in the middle of the day with your hair wet and your clothes wet? And she was very upset, and she said, oh, I just came from the funeral of one of my dear grandchildren. My granddaughter just passed away, and she was very young and very unhappy, and so I wanted I couldn't think of anything better to do at this sad time than to come and visit the monastery and to see you, Venerable Sir. So he said to her, well, Visakha, how is it? Would you like to have as many children and grandchildren as there are people in Sarvati? You know, you already have many, many children, many, many grandchildren, but would you like to have as many children and grandchildren as there are people in Sarvati? She said, oh, surely, yes, it would be lovely, wonderful to have so many children, so many grandchildren. That would be marvelous. That would be a wonderful thing. And then the Buddha said to her, but Visakha, not a day passes in the great city of Sarvati when at least 10 people pass away, or if not 10, at least 9, if not 9, then 8, if not 8, then 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. At least one person passes away every day in the great city of Sarvati. So, Visakha, would there ever be a day that you didn't have your hair and your clothes wet from coming from the funeral of one of those of your children or grandchildren? Would you ever be free from the sorrow of that kind of loss? And Visakha, being as quick as Queen Mallika on the uptake, said, enough of having so many grandchildren. Enough of having so many children, Lord. And he then went on to elaborate on the teaching and saying, suffering is born from those who are dear to us. And the word dear is pia. So this sutta is called the Pia Jataka Sutta, born from those who are dear. Pia Jataka. Jati is birth. And he said, if we have 100 dear ones, we have 100 pains. If we have 90 dear ones, 90 pains. 80 dear ones, 80 pains. 70, 60, 50, 40, 30, 20, 10. 10 dear ones, 10 pains. 9 dear ones, 9 pains. 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. If we have 1 dear one, we have 1 pain. If we have no dear ones, we have no pains. And then encourages that if we want to be free from suffering, if we want to free the heart from those painful experiences, then one of the ways to do that is to free the heart from that quality of binding ourselves, binding the heart to another in that way. So when people hear these teachings or read these teachings, then it can feel like, are we supposed to turn ourselves into just cold fish, just totally insensate, heartless brutes that just have no feeling or no caring? Are we supposed to just sterilize our feelings and have utter indifference to other human beings, to those in our families, our children, our parents? Are we supposed to just be receiving the data of all beings, you know, everything arises and passes away, and just to have a completely inert emotional nature? Like even at the time of the Buddha's final passing away, the Parinibbana, then as the story is described in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, then there were, as it said, those whose hearts were not free from passion, they wept and wailed and beat their breasts and cried, oh, the master has departed, the master has gone, oh dear, oh woe. And were distraught and upset. And then, and in the words of the sutta, it says that for those whose hearts were free from passion, said, what's the point of all this? And they didn't weep and beat their breasts and wail and gnash their teeth. But what's the point of all this? All that is subject to arising is subject to passing away. Yeah, the master has taught us this all his life. So that can, again, that can be read like, gee, that sounds pretty heartless, pretty cold. Is that what we're aiming for? To just be emotionally dead data reception units, just responding to the input of the senses, like a Geiger counter, just clicking on and off when phenomena are experienced? It feels pretty dreadful and uninspiring, painful. Yeah. But also we can feel puzzled because the Buddha also encouraged the quality of love in terms of of great strength, great encouragement. He put a lot of emphasis on the importance of that. One of the most, probably the most often recited teaching of the Buddha, and most frequently recited, like protective verse or blessing verse, is that of the Karaniya Metta Sutta. We did it earlier this evening, just with the news that Vika Browns, partner of Maggie from Yoga Mendocino, she's very close to the end of her life. Just, you know, the hospice nurse saying she probably has hours, maybe days, but maybe less to live. So we began the evening with some Paritta chanting dedicated to her and also for Jay's well-being after his operation and recovery, to wish him well. And in that chanting we did the Karaniya Metta Sutta. And as everyone here knows, you know, the words of that sutta in English contain the words, even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. So it's a paradox, isn't it? How come the Buddha puts that, on the one hand, praises the quality of love and exalts it and says that we should all have the kind of love that a mother has for her only child, for all beings, to cherish all beings, to have unmitigated benevolence towards all beings, but yet at the same time saying, you know, love is the cause of suffering, that born from those that are dear, is suffering. So that if you have 6 billion people on the planet, just in the humans, that's 6 billion pains. If we take in all the animals and the insects, just on the planet, birds and fishes, that's a heck of a lot of dukkha to be experiencing. But what this points to is there's two very different kinds of love that are encompassed in the English word love in the Buddha's teaching, and also you find within the Christian theology as well, Christian way of thinking, that they distinguish different kinds of what the English word love points to. And that the quality of metta, or loving kindness, or loving friendliness, as Bhante-ji likes to translate it, has a very, very different tone to it than the kind of love that is the cause of suffering. Though the word, in those earlier suttas that I was quoting, the word is piya, and is translated as dearness. And what that alludes to is, in a sense, love that's based on self-view, on sakkaya ditti, love that is possessive, is personal, is very much based on the sense of me and you, of self and other. It's based on a solid I, a solid you. And therefore, it's because of that dependence on self-view, on sakkaya ditti, and therefore dependence on that which is unstable and not substantial, not real. Therefore, it's bound to result in suffering. It has to necessarily arrives in suffering, leads to suffering. And it's not necessarily that that in that kind of connection with another there is it's constantly miserable, as we all know. There can be bright and delightful, incredibly pleasing moments, but as the Buddha points out in a number of teachings, with relationship to the sense world and our connection with the things that we see, hear, smell, taste, touch, and think, there's the arising and the fading away of each experience. There's the gratification, but there's also the danger, and then there's the escape, the asada and the adinava, the gratification and the danger. So when we are in love with someone and we connect with someone in that way, and we build a connection based on sakkaya ditti, on the personal qualities, we have not necessarily any clue that's what we're doing. We might feel it's just a natural and ordinary and straightforward and good, beautiful, kind and fine way to relate to another. We don't realize what we're buying into. And it is often remarked upon, especially if you do a lot of teaching. I think Ajahn Pasno and myself, or anyone who's been in the sort of teaching or counseling role for many years or any years at all, you run across the fact that for most people, spreading loving kindness is to all beings is great in principle, but oftentimes the beings that are most difficult to spread kindness to are the ones that we were formerly deeply in love with, or that people were bonded to. So it's the ex-partners, ex-husbands and wives, that are ex-partners that are often the ones that it's the hardest to spread any loving kindness to. That it's really a challenge sometimes for people to be including those that have broken their hearts, disappointed them, and caused them immense difficulty and stress and pain in a relationship, to include them also. May all beings be happy except him. it's a hurdle that people have to climb over. It's a great challenge. And it's not necessarily a rational thing. Well, maybe on the rational and the idealistic level, on the ideal level, we would have no hesitation to send out loving kindness, to have kindness and love for all beings. But when you bring that person to mind, the one that you walk down the aisle with, that then you later were deeply hurt by, or cheated by, or wounded by, or betrayed by, or fought with, or whatever, then that becomes the greatest stumbling block. And even though it's an absurdism to think, you know, may all beings be happy, may all beings in the universe, all human beings, all birds and fishes, all animals, insects, all bacteria, all beings in all different realms, other planets, other universes, you know, from the hell realms to the heaven realms, may they all be happy, may they all be free from suffering. But then when you bring the name to mind of that person, you know, the one that broke your heart and betrayed you and upset you and hurt you deliberately, then there's something that says, yeah, but there's a limit. That's what happens, isn't it? That kind of bonding has its karmic effect. And it's ironic and strange, difficult, that sometimes the ones that we were closest to become the cause of the greatest pain. And that can manifest in all sorts of different ways. Yeah. Just today I was reading about a fellow who, even after his marriage broke up, was insanely jealous of his ex-wife connecting with anybody else, to the point of seemingly murdering one of her possible liaisons that didn't even come to anything. It was just she got together with this person for an evening, and the ex-husband seems to have done him in, and then lining up for another partner that she's taken up with. And even though the marriage is long ended, just insanely jealous and fixated. Obviously, that's a very, very extreme situation. But there's all kinds of different ways that we hang on to each other. We hang on to the hurt feelings that we have. And it's not just in romantic relationships either. This can be the same in spiritual relationships. Say, you know, you connect with a spiritual teacher, and then you put your heart into that, and you idolize the teacher, and you look up to them, and you praise them and adore them and cultivate great devotion to that teacher. And then they treat you badly. They kind of embarrass you in front of everyone, or they throw you out as a student who hasn't got any real spiritual potential. They kind of shame you or dismiss you or sideline you. And so then that, you know, love and devotion and reverence for that teacher then becomes turned to hatred and the desire for revenge. And every opportunity you get to put down so-and-so, like, yeah, he doesn't know what he's talking about, he's stupid, he's kind of got totally riddled with wrong view, and he's a danger to society. And where does that come from? His suffering is born from those that are dear. So it's not just in romantic relationships, it's not just in family situations, but in spiritual dimensions too. If we form a bond based on sakkaya ditti, on self-view, then the result has to be suffering. Suffering is born from those that are dear. If it's possessive, if it's personal, if it's even if it's cast into a spiritual mode, I similarly to being on the receiving end of painful aspects in people's marriages and personal relationships, and similarly, I've been on the receiving end of a lot of people really disgruntled, disaffected with spiritual teachers, and I'm sure there's plenty of been disaffected by me. I've got all kinds of things to say about how I've hurt them, betrayed them, let them down, upset them, sold them short, sidelined them. This is the way that the human mind works, isn't it? This is how it is when we come from ignorance, when our views and our ways of relating and connecting with other beings is based on ignorance. So the love that the Buddha praised, the love of metta, of loving kindness, is in essence non-personal. It's not based on self-view. It's not coming from a place of ignorance. And the Brahma-viharas, the four sublime abidings, metta, karuna, mudita, upekkha, loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, equanimity, these are described by the Buddha as they're not transcendent states, but they are exalted. They are very refined. So they are extremely wholesome. They're conditions of mind. They're impermanent and conditioned like any other kind of mental formation, but they're exalted insofar as that they are the epitome of wholesome mental states. There, and in a way, we can think of them as our emotional nature purified. When the heart is free from greed, hatred, and delusion, then these four qualities define the way that our emotions are directed. So that when the heart is really free from all delusion, all greed, all hatred, all confusion, when there's a total wakefulness and mindfulness, then these qualities of loving kindness, compassion, and so forth, they are what naturally arise in relationship to other beings. So the quality of metta is in itself an expansive, non-personal, and liberating kind of love. It's not a loving that is needy or possessive. So we all know these the difference between these two kinds intuitively. This is not news to us, but the problems come when they get mushed up together, because when we don't see clearly, when the mind is confused and caught up, then that loving kindness metta does get taken over by some hints and suggestions or a total penetration of and being swamped with self-view. So what starts out as an intention to have metta can turn into a passionate romance. Like I didn't hear it myself, but I heard that Ajahn Chah once responded to a question about metta, and he said, too much metta and you get babies. So, I think someone asked him, is metta practice always a good idea? And he said, well, yeah, not always. Too much metta, you get babies. So, but metta, when it's practiced wisely, when it's practiced with real mindfulness and wisdom, then is a liberating kind of love. So it's a... It's not based on self and other. It's based on right view. It's based on attunement of the heart to Dhamma. So these are just some themes to contemplate. The possibility is to hear some words and just make the mind function in a particular desired way, to say, oh, I'm always going to have this kind of love, I'm always going to relate to people like this and never like that. We can't just change a habit by a decision going on in the mind. It's not just a single conceptual thought that has the power to change a habit. But once we recognize these different modes, these different aspects of mind, and we see that's what's happening, then we can more easily recognize those traits. We can recognize, oh, this is the kind of of love or inspiration or devotion, whether it's romantic or whether it's spiritual or whether it's in the family, whether it's to a person or to an institution, like it's love of Theravada Buddhism. You know, it can still, we cling to that, take hold of that in an unskillful way, then it too is going to disappoint us, let us down, betray us, and sell us short and be a cause for suffering. Once we recognize these different modes that we relate to others, and we begin to see the Buddha's truth for ourselves, we see how that suffering is born from that quality of possessive love, dependent and personal love. Once we see that for ourselves, then that the pain that we see within it, even though it might be very sweet on the outside, we can feel that the painfulness is embedded within it. We feel that, we know that, we recognize that. And so then it helps to incline the heart towards that quality of metta. And it's not as though metta is some sort of sterilized and half-hearted kind of love. It's like in the verses that we chant, about the Brahma Viharas, abundant, exalted, immeasurable. These qualities are apamanya. They're limitless. They're infinite. It's the metta, when it's truly cultivated and practiced, when the heart is genuinely imbued with loving kindness, there's an infinitude to it. It's vast and brilliant, all-powerful, universal. Is a tremendous strength and beauty to it. So it's not a wishy-washy alternative without any oomph. A real romance has got that great passion and power and charge to it, and metta is kind of wimpy, sort of unexciting. And half-hearted, a bit sort of diluted and flat. If we really know the heart of loving kindness, if we really practice that, there's no way that we could even think that for a moment. It's just not the case. It can be far more powerful and all pervasive and potent, all encompassing. But it's also a loving quality that is utterly independent. So it's not a matter of not caring about the other. It's not a matter of not feeling the ups and downs of another, or not attuning to the state of other beings. There is an attunement, but the heart's contentment, the heart's freedom, is not reliant upon the feedback that you get from another, whether they approve of you or disapprove of you, whether they're present or absent, whether they're living or dying. That your happiness, your peace of mind, your wholeness is not reliant, it's not dependent on the comings and goings, the ups and downs of another. So it's not as though the heart is tied to the fluctuations of the five khandhas of another. Whereas with that possessive, personal kind of love, that relationships of separateness, as I like to call it, then the heart is tied to the activity of the five khandhas of another. And so if they go up, you go up. If they go down, you go down. If they whirl around, you whirl around. We tied our heart to that. So wherever it goes, that's where the heart goes. So the boundless heart, cherishing all beings, that cherishing is profound and complete and sincere, but it has also this quality of non-attachment, non-entanglement. It's not bonded to the other in any kind of identification. There's no possessiveness, and so that then there's a freeing quality. And one of the ways that that I was very struck by listening to Ajahn Jamnian a number of years ago when he was giving advice to a couple, he gave them a wedding blessing, and he said, if you look upon your marriage or your wedding, like the two of you just looking at each other and thinking that he thinks it's his job to make her happy and she thinks it's her job to make him happy, or he thinks it's her job to make him happy or she thinks it's his job to make her happy. You know, if you think like that and all you do is look at each other, all you will create is suffering, because it's impossible for us to please each other all of the time. I can't please you all of the time. You can't please me all of the time. And if I think it's my job to make you happy all the time, I'm going to suffer. If I think if it's your job to make me happy all the time, I'm going to suffer. And we're all going to suffer. So rather than a relationship depending on just looking at each other, if instead you're, and he's changed the gesture of his fingers from sort of pointing to each other, point to point. So if they're side by side, if rather you look at your relationship as a partnership, looking at that which is beyond both of you, then it can be a successful relationship. And that's true whether it's a romantic relationship, whether it's a parent-child relationship, whether it's a relationship with a spiritual teacher or your fellows in the monastic life whatever it might be. It's the same thing. If you're looking to the teacher to be the source of all goodness and all happiness and all truth and all value, the teacher's going to disappoint you, or they're going to send you away, or you're going to, when the teacher goes or dies or runs off and gets married, you're going to be heartbroken, disappointed. How could he do that? I mean, he gave that talk about that hour-long rap about the downfall of the shortcomings of romantic love, and he runs off with a 16-year-old the next day. How could he do that? That's outrageous. Ajahn Amaro has broken my heart. I have no plans, by the way. Just in case anyone's wondering. And he even said he had no plans. What a rat. I'm never going to trust another monk ever again. How could they do that? This is how we tie the heart to that which is undependable. You know, we fixate and get lost in that. But if we're wise, then we have loving kind, you know, the quality of loving kindness, then we're shifting the view from nose to nose and just staring at each other to looking at which is beyond ourselves. To yes, well, there's the teachers, and yes, there's Theravada Buddhism, yes, there's this person that I'm married to, or this person is my parent, or my child, or my sibling, or all the different ways we might have of relating to each other. But if we look beyond the personal, if we look at this as a collaboration to look at that which is beyond Theravada Buddhism, beyond teacher-student, beyond sibling, beyond partner, and partner, parent and child, just relating as two beings together, then you see, well, the role of parent or child or grandchild or of wife, husband, partner, you know, teacher, student, senior monk, junior monk, novice, that these are empty formations. These are simply designations woven together out of social convention, nothing more. And that if we use those conventions wisely and sincerely and honorably, and look at that which is beyond them, then those conventions serve us well. And the connection, the commitment that we have, the integrity that we have, and serves and supports our transcendence, the liberation of the heart, that faithfulness, commitment. You know, faithfulness to the monastery, or faithfulness to your partner, or faithfulness to your family. That helps. It's a spiritual support. It's a powerful presence that enables liberation, it enables the wholesome and noble qualities of the heart to come to maturity. And so that then that connection, that closeness, that sincerity, that strength of bond is a support. But if the bond is based on self-view, then it will only serve to limit. And when something changes about the other person or ourselves, or they leave, or they die, or they disappoint us, then we die too. We die because we've been born into that bond, that way of connecting. And that's the only result that can come about. So these are some reflections for this particular day, this night, and may whatever is useful be taken in and cherished, and whatever is not, then please leave aside.
Dhammayang dhammakataya sadhu karang dadama.